friends, please let me begin by reading to you a paragraph which occurs in Madame Blavatsky's first monumental work, Isis Unveiled. After spending 3 or 4 pages describing Plato and his philosophy, this is how she sums up. Such is Platonism. Out of Plato, says Ralph Waldo Emerson, come all things that are still written and debated among men of thought. He absorbed the learning of his times. Of Greece, from Philolaus to Socrates, then of Pythagoras in Italy, then what he could procure from Egypt and the East. He was so broad that all philosophy, European and Asiatic, was in his doctrines. And to culture and contemplation, he added the nature and qualities of the poet. Our appreciation of Plato goes so far that it explains why a devotional reading from the Bhagavad Gita was considered appropriate. That particular chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is called Purushottama Yoga, devotion or the method of union with the spirit by realizing the nature of the highest spiritual element, Purushottama. Plato is one of those who have indicated to us, partly by rational argument and partly by that poetic quality that is referred to, what the presence of that spiritual element in this world is like. In the ordinary sense, he was not an orthodox or a pious or a religious man. In fact, as you know, he was the greatest disciple of the man whom Athens put to death as a heretic, as one who was upsetting all their inherited sense of religion and piety among the youths, misguiding Athenian youths and so on. And indeed, one of Plato's most wonderful writings is the Apology. It's a dialogue called the Apology, which is about the life and deaths of Socrates. That also comes in other dialogues, but the Apology is devoted to this. Indeed, some of Plato's manner of writing is to be linked with this one tremendous relationship in his life, his relationship to Socrates. When you read the actual dialogues, you hardly ever find Plato saying, "I think so," or "this is my view." What you have is a kind of drama, as if he was writing a play, in which a number of people, usually young, bright inquirers who hold all kinds of views, are discussing things with Socrates. And Socrates deals with them not by laying down the law, he never does that. He deals with them with what has then traditionally come to be called Socratic irony. That is, he always begins by saying, "But I don't know the answer to that. I don't know what the truth about this is. Let us see if we can find out. Will you perhaps," and it's sometimes, many of the dialogues are named after the people with whom Socrates is discussing something. So he might say, "Theaetetus, will you please tell me, I don't know about this." There is one man in one dialogue who is about to go and denounce his own father to the authorities because that father has thrashed a slave unmercifully and injured him. And this son is going to go and denounce the father. And he considers this a thing full of integrity and piety that he should do this. And Socrates makes him sit down and say, "But then you must be very sure indeed of what is the right thing to do if you are going to denounce your own father." You must be very sure of what is integrity and piety. I don't know, please tell me. And this is how the whole discussion of what is integrity, what is right conduct begins. And 9 times out of 10, when somebody says something, Socrates puts a further question. He doesn't say you're wrong, he puts a further question. But if we say this, he'll always say that, if we say what you're suggesting, then this further implication arises. Do we accept that? Can we accept it? If not, how shall we modify our first statement? Shall we say this? Would that be acceptable? And bit by bit by bit, the interlocutor, the other person, is led to see for himself that actually, rationally, philosophically, his view needs to be adjusted. This, of course, was not just a habit. Socrates is traditionally said to have announced that the uncriticized life is not worth living. Uncriticized does not mean that which is blamed or censured. It means that which is not critically examined with the highest reason. Because we may do many things. Many things occur to us. We do them from habit. We do them from impulse. But a life that is like this will be inconsistent. It may be inconsistent within itself. That is, what you do today may not be consistent with what you're going to do tomorrow. It may also be inconsistent with your own permanent character, if you have one. Socrates would have been prepared to discuss that at great length. Have we, or have you not got a permanent character? It might be inconsistent with something which is the permanent nature of humanity. Does humanity have a permanent character or not? He would have been willing to discuss that. It might be inconsistent with truth or beauty or goodness, if there are such definite things. Are there not? All these. Now, this Socratic irony, and this is what is called dialectic. The thing that arises from the discussion between people who are open-minded and who pursue the truth. Socrates, therefore, is a fundamental thing. And in this respect, Plato is very much like the great acharyas of Indian tradition. It is said of them in Sanskrit, Yam acharyanam shaili swabhiprayam api, that whatever they want to indicate or tell you, they express as a comment on the traditional works. As though it is there in the traditional works. They never say, this is a new thing which I am saying. You know, the contributions of the great Shankaracharya, who comes to mind when you are reading Plato, I'll say in a moment why. But so much, almost all his best work is in the form of commentaries on this Upanishad, commentaries on the Brahma Sutra, commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita. Hardly ever, I can't think of any text of Shankaracharya's where he says, this is what I, Shankaracharya, think. It's all interpretation of the great text. Anyhow, Plato, therefore, is, as it were, conveying what he wants to convey to us as what his great teacher Socrates brought out, or at least by the method that he adopted. Nevertheless, to the student of theosophy, there is another side to Plato. In the little announcement that we put out, we put down, because we thought in Bombay as it is, there might be a lot of people who don't know who Plato was or what it's all about. So we put down what the dictionary says about him, at least an encyclopedic kind of dictionary says about him, that Plato lived about 427 to 348 BC. By the way, different authorities give these dates slightly differently, but there is no difficulty about the fact that he did live in a particular period of Athenian culture. Athens, after its golden age under Pericles. Athens was beginning to decline when Plato lived. And that he did live most of his life in the 5th century BC, but continued a little into the 4th century. The date of his death, for instance, by someone else is given as 331 BC and so on. A few years here and there doesn't matter. Greek philosopher, pupil of Socrates, and author of dialogues based on the teaching of Socrates and the doctrines of Pythagoras. This is important, that after all, Plato had assimilated the great Pythagorean tradition, which was simultaneously scientific, philosophical, and mystical. I'm sure that most of us suffered from Pythagoras' theorem at a young age. However, Pythagoras had a school in which it was a strict rule that to start studying philosophy at all, you had to have done a certain amount of mathematics and music. Pythagoras thought that if you didn't know mathematics and music at least a little, you are not fit to start on philosophy. Also in his school, there was a stage called acousticoi. It's the same Greek root from which you get the modern word acoustics. Those who listened. For those 2 years or so, they were not allowed even to ask questions. They just listened. Then you came to asketai, those who practiced. Other stages. Now, Pythagoras, also by the way, was responsible for such a wonderful key ideas and mystical feelings as the music of the spheres. And Plato had assimilated all that. However, Madame Blavatsky has a little note on Plato in her Theosophical Glossary, in which she says, Plato, an initiate into the mysteries and the greatest Greek philosopher whose writings are known the world over. An initiate into the mysteries. Now, this aspect of his life is known. It's not that the Theosophists are saying something for the first time, but they feel that this is very important. In this respect, he differed from his teacher Socrates, because Socrates was not initiated into the mysteries. There was a rule, apparently, that someone who had a particular physical difficulty, which Socrates sometimes had, could not be initiated into the mysteries. Plato himself certainly was initiated. What the mysteries were, well, there are whole books about it and Theosophy explains, but they were a very important thing. And in one place, HBB quotes an authority who says that the mysteries became a discipline and an inducement to virtue. That was their nature. So how they were conducted is a different matter. There is a lot about it in Theosophical literature. Now, where shall we, as it were, approach this wonderful mind of Plato's? It's so vast in some ways that I'm reminded of a joke that the late G.K. Chesterton made. He said, a poet only tries to get his head into the clouds, and that's all right, he may or he may not. But a certain kind of intellectual tries to get the whole world into his head, and then the poor head bursts. That's only Chesterton's joke, but a problem like that one faces when dealing with Plato. To really try to get it all in like that, the poor head will burst. It has to be done slowly, and it would take a very long time of study. It's not only that he was the greatest of the Greek philosophers. It is that he has governed one whole side of the Western mind. Unfortunately, Plato was lost. That is to say, during the Dark Ages, when all that Greece had to give was lost for some time, medieval Europe first recovered Aristotle. But they had only little bits of Plato, a few fragments. Scholars have identified which fragments were available at which time and when the rest of Plato gradually became available. And meanwhile, the church, which at that time was only the Catholic Church, the other denominations had not come up, had got a great hold on the mind of people. That was one side of it. The other side was that all learning was under the auspices of the church. And very great Christian thinkers, people like St. Thomas Aquinas, went by Aristotle. Aristotle was called the master of those who knew, and so on. Now, that's all very well. He was a very great man. He was a pupil of Plato's, actually. However, he also diverged in an important respect. It's not just one opinion and another. There are two whole ways of thought. The way that Plato followed, under the guidance of Pythagoras and Socrates and so on, certainly was a rational way, but it was also a way that tried to find a basis always in some universal principle relating to whatever subject was in hand. From the universal, it would try to work towards the particulars, try to work towards the implications, and it distrusted the collection of a few particulars. Aristotle, on the other hand, was one of the earliest people in the world who taught his pupils to go collecting facts, as you might call them. When he was Alexander's tutor in Macedon, Alexander and the companions who were also ordered by his father, King Philip, to be with him, were sent on little expeditions to collect specimens of botanical this and specimens of animals this and so forth. Not that that is a useless activity, but this became the approach. The Aristotelian habit of mind of moving from particulars towards generalization or the universals is the other great choice for rational thinking. And because Plato was missing during those crucial centuries, this took hold of the Christian world and of the Western mind. So much so that when it was further restated by Francis Bacon and the awakening of what you might call the scientific period, 17th century, a little after Newton, or about just before, actually Bacon was a little before, Newton comes a little later. Bacon actually spoke of putting nature to the question. Now, this sounds innocent to the 20th century mind. Of course, you must put questions to nature and find out the answers. But putting nature to the question had an ugly implication in Bacon's time. Putting somebody to the question meant try to make him give whatever evidence he had in a legal case or a criminal case by torturing him. So that faint echo of disrespect for nature, of treating nature as an unwilling witness who could be tortured into telling you what you want, this habit of exploiting nature, which has dominated modern civilization since the 17th, 18th centuries, until now it is beginning to be slowly reversed by the ecological movement and our awareness of it. Only little, we're still doing it, but at least we're talking about the wrong attitude involved. Much of this is connected with Aristotle and then Bacon. The absence of Plato has been tragic for the whole development of Western philosophical and social. Also, this is one side of it. So I'm trying to say that it's not just that Plato was one philosopher in the 5th century BC that is interesting and important to study. Of course he is that, but there's more to it than that. The whole civilization has been shaped in one way by his absence, but after all he was rediscovered, and once he was rediscovered, he had an enormous influence. I didn't bring it down, but in our library on the third floor, which is mentioned, I found one translation of some Platonic dialogues by Thomas Taylor, made and published in 1792. The book is still in excellent condition. It can be read. So right from then, once Plato was rediscovered, people have turned to it. There are journals which are called, or have been journals, which are called The Platonist, which only devoted to the study and discussion of Plato. Very well. Right in the 20th century, when Professor Alfred North Whitehead began to publish his summary, as it were, of modern philosophy, trying to take into account what modern physics had discovered, seeing how it fitted into the total rationalizations of philosophy. This is the kind of thing which he said. His most important book, Whitehead's most important book, is called Process and Reality. That book is introduced with a statement of the author's belief that the train of thought in these lectures is Platonic. He goes further and describes the whole European philosophical tradition as consisting of a series of footnotes to Plato. That's what Whitehead said. And this is not just rhetoric. The little textbook of philosophy which I was using to find this has two important chapters on basic problems in philosophy which can only be discussed in the light of Plato. One is Plato's theory of ideas. Now you notice that our lecture title was Plato and his ideas. Now obviously any great philosopher has important ideas to present. But in Plato's case, one doesn't mean only that. One means that the central thing that he talked about was ideas. He used the Greek word, of course, which can be translated differently. The other translation is forms. The translation can be ideas, it can be forms. What Plato said was, and he demonstrates this in some of the dialogues, there is a long discussion that Socrates takes his friends through. Hold on. Suppose you see something and you call it beautiful. Or you see something, you call it good. And maybe, in fact, he doesn't say that, but you see something square or red. But there are many such things. There are many things that people might call beautiful or good or square or red. They are not alike. In many ways, those things are different. Perhaps no two of them are quite like each other. And yet they are all beautiful, good, square, red. What is this universal thing? Beauty or goodness or squareness or redness or triangularity, what is it that is present in innumerable examples of beautiful things or red things or triangles, but which you never find by itself? We have all seen equilateral triangles and isosceles triangles and large triangles and small ones. Have you ever seen triangularity? And yet there is a universal nature of triangles to which any triangle must conform, otherwise it's not a triangle at all. Now, of course, among philosophers there are endless debates about this. In Middle Ages there were the realists and the nominalists, the people who said that, oh, redness is only a name, nominalists. The other people, they were called realists, it's a technical term, different from what we now might mean by realism, who said, no, it's a real thing. Now, Plato is one of probably the most important thinkers in the history of the world as we know it, who made it clear that the universal is not just something, a word or a label that you people have given. It exists. To do this, and in explaining all this, of course, what he was doing was bringing together and clarifying a whole problem in Greek philosophical history. You see, in Greek philosophical history, two great things were said, both very important. And they have been said by other very great philosophers and spiritual teachers in different contexts. One is that everything that you can observe is constantly changing. The Greek Heraclitus, before Plato, said, you cannot bathe in the same river twice. Because the second time you go, the river had changed. But there was another great man called Parmenides who pointed out that nothing which exists can vanish out of existence. That if there is no permanence, you can't deal with reality. What Plato did was to take both these things, put them together and produce a lucid statement. So what he says is, look, anything which you see, which keeps changing, in a sense, doesn't have total reality. You can't know it, because to know something means to be aware of it in all its aspects and to be aware correctly or accurately. But any such awareness that you form becomes invalid tomorrow, if the thing itself changes. So he says, about such things you can have opinions, but you can't have knowledge. That is an important step in one of the Socratic dialogues. Well, and of course there is this, behind the argument, there is the passion, the devotion, that you must have a real knowledge. The life of a man is not worth anything if it is not devoted to real knowledge. So this opinion, this water, that's not Plato, but the textbooks of philosophy that explain Plato, that the kind of water which a man may call warm if he's coming from the cold, and he may call it cool if he just emerged out of boiling hot shower. This is, what is it? This is not knowledge. This is opinion. I call it warm, you call it cold. Things must have their own real nature. Of course, this nature has to work through what Heraclitus has pointed out, a continually changing world of form. A world, the visible world, the world of matter. And of course, there is a great deal of technical, philosophical explanation of what that world is like. What makes it even approximately knowable is that it follows or obeys a consistent pattern. The world itself is shapeless and constantly changing, but it obeys a consistent pattern, a set of laws. Where do they come from? How can something which is itself shifting like sand all the time provide them? Plato says no. On another and a higher level of reality, there are ideas or forms which are real because they do not change. They are real because they do not change. They govern the flux, the constant change in the universe. Indeed, they give recognizable shapes or qualities or characteristics to the things in the world we know. Otherwise, those things would be a mere shapeless chaos. And in fact, in the technical language of Greek religion and philosophy, he pointed out that whatever the ultimate reality might be, it was by the impression of the divine mind upon chaos that you have a world which is a cosmos. In fact, he says metaphorically that chaos or infinite substance is like the mother from whom the sun, the actual universe, is born. The father, so to speak, is ideas in the divine mind. And this, the term idea, by the way, which we have in English, is only a copy of a Greek word. And the Greek word has a shifting couple of shades of meaning. One is a sharp image. The other is eidolon, a sort of fleeting impression of something else which is there. Plato is saying very clearly that the idea governs things. And so the familiar sentence which we even put in an announcement, ideas rule the world. Now, this also makes Plato compatible in the great discussion that has arisen after modern physics. Because you see, in modern physics, matter has become exactly what Plato said philosophically it was. Something which has no solidity, something which has no permanent shape, something which cannot be located or described very accurately. If you describe the velocity of a particle, you can't describe its location. If you describe its location, you can't describe its velocity. If you call the thing a particle, you find that in fact it's a series of electrical charges. And in general, Bertrand Russell, I think, was driven to say, matter, that is what happens where matter is not. That's Bertrand Russell, not me. So, in this situation, academic teachers of philosophy and those physicists who take an interest in philosophy are finding Plato a way out. They said no. The kind of thing that Plato said is compatible with their discovery that the only thing they can be accurate about is a mathematical description of reality. The mathematics is accurate. All other descriptions are very approximate and inaccurate. But this mathematics being accurate fits in all right with Plato. Because you see, Plato, when he speaks of approaching reality, speaks of several stages. And in those several stages, the highest are not physical at all. Especially when you take his very, the classic passage in the Symposium, that's one of the dialogues, the Symposium, where he represents as Socrates himself being instructed by Diotima, a lady who was, a mystic, I suppose. Some people have called her a prophetess, but that does not seem very accurate. But Socrates is humble enough to visit her and talk to her and learn from her. So he is a famous teacher and she is not. And Diotima exists. And they go together, agree together that a man advances from, let us say, admiring the beauty of a handsome youth or a beautiful girl to admiring the idea of a shape in the abstract, to admiring the beauty of conduct, to admiring the beauty of principles, until you go to the ultimate principle of all principles, which is beauty. And you see, in that Greek tradition, it was already thought, what an English poet wrote many centuries later, but it was thought. Euclid alone has seen beauty bare. That the highest experience of beauty is mathematical. It's not the particular color or the particular texture. Euclid alone saw beauty bare. Of course, that was a Greek thought which an English poet put into words comparatively recently. Now, Plato, by doing this, we certainly realize that this philosophy is also an actual analysis of human experience. And so, this thing of his about going from the universals to the particulars becomes an important contribution to what in modern days is called epistemology, the science of what knowledge is. There are many theories, naturally. Plato gives solid support to one approach, that there is an actual universe. Otherwise, there are philosophical problems in which people say, no, but I have my views and I have my experiences and he has his experiences and there are difficulties and we don't always agree and there are different theories. So where is reliable or solid reality? Plato, the philosopher, who sounds so abstract, in fact has given a solid reality back to the universe in the sense of saying, yes, matter is only a constant flux which you can't rely upon. But behind it, there is a universe there which doesn't change, which is impersonal, which is universal. What I think or you think or he, she, it think doesn't change it. This assurance is now tenable by very few philosophers and very few scientists. The few, therefore, who have gone back to Plato find it very reassuring. The same thing happens with regard to the study of aesthetics. Professor Jode, in the textbook of philosophy to which I was referring, has a whole chapter in which he shows how in aesthetics people say, some people say Bach is a great musician and other people think that jazz rock is great music. And it's what anybody likes. How is one to determine? But Plato saying firmly, there is an idea of beauty which exists on its own plane, quite apart from anybody's things. That is supporting the view of those who are bewildered, because they are quite sure from their aesthetic experience, they are quite sure that there is such a thing as high quality in music or painting or sculpture. That it's not nonsense that centuries later we should respect the painting of Raphael or Michelangelo, or the poetry of Pindar or Dante or Shakespeare. That this is not nonsense. But to make philosophical sense of it, you need Plato. Not perhaps put in his language. And since, as I said, it would take a very long time to really discuss Plato at any kind of length, we shall see that while he pins, as it were, underpins science on the one side, our sense of beauty and art on the other side, actually he goes beyond all this. Now there are two, three things that are said very specially, which are not found in ordinary books, which are said in Madame Blavatsky's works, to which I should like to draw your attention. There are a lot more. It just shows the kind of mind he had. For example, he, having embraced the ideas of Pythagoras, and Pythagoras had brought them from India to some extent, he compiled and published them in a form which was more intelligible, the way he puts his philosophical things. For example, the whole thing that is at the back of astrology, the idea of a planet or a star exerting some strange influence. Plato thought, like Pythagoras, like the ancient Indians, that it is not just the planet or the star itself, that behind each planet or a star is a great conscious cosmic intelligence. They use the word rector. You know, like we used to say the rector of the university. There is a rector or a regent to each planet or star. And that much of the ancient talk about what the stars or planets do, if it is to make sense, is not about the movement of the physical star or planet. It's about the nature and activities of the rector, who's a kind of intelligence that later ages would have called angelic or archangelic, but in Plato's terms, at an earlier stage of that emanation from Agathon, that is his word for the ultimate good, then through its impression on chaos you get logos, that's his word also. Logos is of course simply Greek for word, but it has a very special meaning, because from this logos emanate or radiate like rays great conscious cosmic or angelic intelligences, and therefore these forms or ideas that he regards as really there, as universal, are not only abstractions. They are alive, they are animate with a life which is angelic or divine. In Plato's time, the word divine did not necessarily mean referring to a god who is the creator. In fact, Plato himself defined the word theos as derived from the Greek verb theain, which means to move. The source of motion, that which animates from within and moves, is divine. And in fact, in later ages, Plato himself has been described as the divine Plato. But that only means, not that he's a god, it means, as in Indian tradition, you might say about something, this is divya, so celestially good. It means that really. But this contribution of Plato is important, because the word logos became the focal point of Christianity when it tried to explain its beliefs in philosophical terms. And the great saying in St. John, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. but St. John wrote in Greek. And what he really said was logos. And that logos is a legacy from Plato. That meaning given to the word. The Greek word only simply meant word literally. Logos as that divine energy which is the first thing in the manifested universe. Because the agathon is totally unreachable. It's like the Indian Parabrahma, totally unreachable. Chaos, by its nature, is an infinite potentiality, a substance, again, like the Indian Mula Prakriti. But it's through it that an actual universe has to manifest. And the control of the actual universe, the manifestation, belongs to the Logos. Therefore, at the heart of many other things which became very, how shall I say, ordinary, pious or religious, not very philosophical, but the concept of the Logos came to the general Western civilization from Plato. Then, and of course students of theosophy will recognize how close all this is to the first fundamental proposition of the secret doctrine. Then, Plato speaks of the eternal idea as the equivalent of the Logos. So he has this feeling about the eternal idea, something reflected in the divine mind, which then differentiates and has many aspects. Let's say truth or goodness or beauty. That trinity, by the way, belongs to Pythagoras, who started talking in those terms. And therefore the idea of beauty is an aspect of a divine structure of the universe. It controls and governs the changing processes, the incomplete capacities of matter. So what happens when we recognize beauty, or when we recognize goodness? Plato says that just as all these things have come from the Logos, we, the soul, the Greek word for that is psyche, from which you now get psychology and all that, it has also come by steps into which we can't go now, from there. So that when the psyche was still with God, that's to say, still not differentiated or crystallized away from the agathon or the Logos, naturally, it participated in that divine eternal idea. Here, because it has to work through matter, also because it has to, he has that wonderful image of the charioteer with two horses. And because sometimes here it loses control of the horses, then it forgets. But sometimes a thing is made so, the forgetting, he has a technical term for it, it's called anamnesis. Plato forget his system. But sometimes a thing is so beautiful or good or self-evidently true that it wakes in the soul or psyche a memory of what it knew when it was an undifferentiated part of divine reality. So that when I see, call something beautiful truly, I'm not merely expressing my liking or disliking, I am not merely expressing my personal emotion, it is a memory of a reality. And the thing deserves my thanks because it reminded me of a divine life to which I belonged in my origin as a soul. And therefore his whole structure is recovery of memory. And then of course there is the whole prescription of how a man ought to live. Now I have said nothing about his political contribution, and our time is up, but that political contribution, which comes in the famous dialogue, The Republic, is essentially that if human beings are to live worthily, they must live in these terms. That is, in such a way that the soul has many opportunities of seeing and remembering what it knew on the higher level of its original life. That it has opportunities of moving from beautiful forms to beautiful conduct, and beautiful conduct to beautiful principles. that it has, in short, the opportunity of making this great return journey, returning back to divinity. Therefore, of course, and I'm saying this in shorthand, as it were, the state has to be guided by those who have already done this. In short, by the philosopher king. And he says that the philosopher king, if he's really one, won't want to rule. Because power in our worldly sense, importance in our worldly sense is exactly what he doesn't value, he doesn't want it. So that people will have to go and beg him to take charge. A good state is one in which all the other people go and beg the philosopher in this sense, one who has realized the original divine experience. Something where people go and beg him to take charge, and then if he takes charge and guides them. And he there refers to a wonderful bit of Greek myth, where he says when Saturn, that is Kala, the deity of time itself, ruled, he saw that no man was fit to rule another, that it would always lead to injustice and trouble, and therefore gave the earliest human beings in the Golden Age rulers who were divine or semi-divine or heroes. This is of course exactly like the Indian notion of the Rajarshis, the adept kings that Mira Blavatsky explains about. But since we don't have the divine dynasties of the adept kings or Rajarshis